Hello, and welcome to Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and I'm happy you can join me today for this very special Real Talk special. Our topic, mass incarceration, is a term bandied about in the media to the point of numb insignificance, but the facts are revealing. Here in Washington State, black prisoners account for 18% of the prison population and just 4% of the state's total. Those numbers are about people, individuals who are parents, spouses, grandchildren, and children, many of whom are young black men whose entire lives are determined by their biggest mistakes, horrible choices they made as adolescents when no one was there to direct them otherwise. I am joined today by three men who embody these statistics. And I'm happy to report they're out of prison and are making significant contributions on the outside as members of the Black Prisoners Caucus and of our community. They are Grady Mitchell, who among many other commitments is an HEAL circle facilitator with Collective Justice, a facilitator and master trainer for Roots of Success, an environmental literacy and job training program. He is also a motivational speaker and consultant. He spent 37 years in Washington State penitentiaries, and he lives by a mantra from Sir Edmund Burke. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good people to do nothing. He is the married father of six and grandfather of 10 wonderful kids. Welcome, Grady.
Good morning. Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Willie Nobles is a member of the Black Prisoners Caucus Community Group, committed to liberation education, advocacy work, courtroom support, and building community. He served 25 years of a 96-year prison sentence. While incarcerated, he helped to start a university inside and is still working behind bars from the outside. He works for criminal justice, at-risk youth, prison reform, and building community. Undoing the social structures of discrimination, inequality, and oppression is his work. He is featured in the documentary film Since I've Been Down, which can be found on Amazon Prime and the Sundance Channel. Welcome, Willie.
Good morning. Thank you so much for allowing me to share this space.
Glad to have you. And Cyril Walrond, who applies his lived experience in prison to confront the perpetual harm in our criminal legal system and to remove barriers to successful reintegration for returning community members. He is an inspiring and engaging public speaker, facilitator, trainer, and consultant. Cyril works as the outreach and advocacy manager for the University Beyond Bars, is a longstanding member of the Black Prisoners Caucus, and like Grady, he serves on the Roots of Success Advisory Board and as a master trainer and instructor. He is an anti-racist organizer and undoing institutional racism trainer with the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, along with being a proud member of the Russell Family Foundation's Jane Fellowship Program's 10th cohort. That is a mouthful. Currently on his own journey of reintegration after having been incarcerated since the age of 17, Cyril remains committed to healing and humanizing work within himself and the community he serves. Welcome, Cyril. Welcome to all of you gentlemen. I am so grateful for the fact that you are here to take time with us on Real Talk. And I want to shout out to Janie Starr and the members of the Vashon Surge Chapter's Criminal Justice Action Team who made this show possible. So we only have an hour and less than that now, since there was so much to say about you. I want to open with a question that I think might be on many folks' minds, and that is, what is your attitude toward your victims when you committed whatever crimes it was you committed, both at the time you were tried and now in retrospect? Grady?
So I think, actually I feel my attitude towards my victims was one of shame and guilt for my actions. Definitely remorse. If there was an opportunity that I would have to rewind and go back, definitely things would have been differently. Having said that, as I go now, it's almost a point where I charge myself to always, what can I do better today than I did yesterday? It's also a very emotional spot for me. Very emotional, very personal. While I use it to motivate me and to encourage others to allow their greatness to come out and be there, those are my quiet spaces when I look at myself and I say, man, I just can't allow myself to be defined by that worst mistake, right? By that worst act or that worst deed. But nonetheless, it's still there. It's still there. I think of it. I don't relish on it and just hold it, but it is a driver for me. You ask my feelings, shame, guilt, humiliation. Definitely, I'm very, very humbled by it because that's not the person that I am, nor is it the person that I believe that I was raised to be.
Thank you. Thank you for that candor. Willie?
I think for me, I feel the same way as Grady, very remorseful. And at the same time, it's the drive behind the man I am today. So even though it's the worst, I believe one of the worst mistakes I've done in my life, it drives me, and I think it's the motivation that makes me do the things that I do today. It makes me do the work that I do today, right? So for me, like he said, it's hurtful, it's sorrow, it's those things, but it's also the things that all of us do today, not only for our victims, but also for the many victims that have been in society, in the community, right? So for us, it's giving back and helping those victims understand the truth, right? Because none of the situations is not a good thing either way. So for us, it's our motivation. It's most definitely one of the worst days, but for us, we turned it into one of our best days to do the work. So that's where I stand on that.
Clearly, you're using that energy for the good. How about you, Cyril?
Yeah, thank you for this question. You know, I've spent a lot of time not only thinking about these type of things, but reflecting personally on what I felt, mm-hmm. right? And thinking about how much shame I felt and guilt I felt, how much embarrassment I felt. And furthermore, I would say initially I didn't do enough thinking about what my victims felt. Right, what their experience was, the harm that I've committed and caused on them, and how they had to live with that. It was easy to make myself to be a victim in that moment, right? When in reality, it was my choice that caused so much harm on the people that I hurt. And so as there was a shift in my life where I began to realize that it was my actions that did this, I also had to take accountability for my actions and understand that accountability equates to action itself. And so I began to go on a quest to not only transform my life and dig up the roots and the things that led me down the path in which I was even in a place to harm the people in which I have, but furthermore, to be intentional about honoring the life that was lost in my case and those who I've hurt, not just including my family, but the community at large. And so much of the work that I've done and continue to do is built and rooted in that, and understanding that it was because I did not have a true understanding, depth, or appreciation for my own humanity, it was easy for me to dehumanize others and see less than them, in which I was able to take things that belonged to them. I was able to take a life that did not belong to me and ultimately do so much harm that I'm working now and endlessly continuing to work on restoration and reconciliation with those who I've hurt and harmed.
Cyril, you bring up a real interesting point for me. When you mentioned you, at the time you committed your crime, did not recognize your own humanity. Say more about that. Why? What was it that made you, that put you there?
I feel like when we think about just what does it mean to be human, right? Or what does it mean to be a black man, a black person, a black woman or child in society that is often telling us that we're not enough, right? In a society that's often telling us that we are wrong, that our value, our experiences are not validated, right? You know, and even in the social economics of the communities in which we come from and the impoverished communities or the different stratospheric structures that are in place, or we could look at the realities of institutionalized racism, or internalized racial oppression, right? These things begin to manifest in not only how we see ourselves, but how we see one another, oftentimes doing harm to one another. And furthermore, how we see those in our communities that we often don't even consider to be a part of our community.
Among the three of you, you've spent about 79 years behind bars. I want our audience to get a sense from you of what that was like. What did a day look like? What was your feeling the first time you heard in court that you were sentenced to life without parole, Grady Mitchell?
I wanted to go back to the cell. I just couldn't believe it. It was like, what is that? What is life without parole? What does that mean? I don't remember my thoughts. I can remember thoughts previous to that, but just that thought is really, really, how can you process that? I believe my first real feeling about that came when you enter the system, you go through an initial classification process where they do so many things, they calculate your time and do all this. Well, at that time they had, and let me just real quickly, when I was sentenced and committed, it wasn't the Department of Corrections. It was Department of Social Health and Services. Department of Corrections didn't even exist at that time.
Really?
Right. So when I was incarcerated, Department of Corrections didn't exist. That came about a year later, I think. So, and what happens is they take you through a classification process, and they told me I had 999 years, 99 months, and 99 days. And I think that's when it hit me, 999 years. It was like, what?
That's unfathomable.
And then I began to process things dangerously, because then I became angry. Like Cyril said, I began to look for reason. Man, this is really not who I was, who I wanted to be. I lived up to an image that was created for me that wasn't the image that I wanted for myself. And I didn't know how to be that independent thinker. And what that did is translated from the reason, the harm that I had experienced pre-incarceration, over and spilled into incarceration, that I began to do the same thing. Now I have to live up to the image of prison mores, right? I have to now become a norm in this society. And how do I achieve that?
And what did that mean?
It means you have to come in fighting. You have to come in letting people know you're not a punk. You have to come in demanding your respect. You have to come in. It's a us versus them mentality. It's what they call the convict code, right? This is a code that no one knows where it came from. No one knows who created it, but it's full of malarkey. It's draconian. It's old, it's played out, because it goes against humanity. It goes against the simple principles and tenets of humanity. No one has to tell me about respect. No one has to tell me how to treat others with dignity, how not to steal. People don't have to tell me. I don't need a code to dictate to me. It was that similar code that got me incarcerated, believing into a code, and here I was fitting into the system again. So when Department of Corrections took over, they changed the code. They said, no, we're going to give you a date. We're going to give you, I was like, "Woo, okay, we're going to get to 999 years off, right? Well, Department of Corrections, I don't know if it was their sense of humor or what, we got to give you 777 years, 77 months, and 77 days, right?
Well, that's a date.
Right. So this is their code for life without the possibility of parole. And everyone around, people, when you don't have years and you have letters as a sentence, everyone around you treats you differently. And I'm talking about peers. I'm talking about other inmates, residents, whatever we choose to call. They treat us differently. In other words, we don't have anything to lose. We shouldn't care when actually we have the most to lose.
Yeah.
When you have those long sentences, you have the most to lose. So those were my initial thoughts just going into the system. I remember those very, very clearly as I was like in my first 2 years.
That has to be terrifying.
I was afraid, but I couldn't show that, right? Because we have this patriarchal masculinity, right, that we have to uphold, that only now is going to be exacerbated because I'm incarcerated now. You know, that I can't cry, I can't show any weakness, I can't show any fears. Just so many things that I'm processing along with. They're talking about I have to die here, that this is the rest of my life.
Willie, I see you over there nodding. What were your feelings when you were first incarcerated, and how did you survive that time?
The crazy thing about my situation is, just like Sarah was talking about, the social structures, right? Community, the things that are upbringing, right? Those are things that I have to put into play when I talk about when I first got resentenced. When I first got sentenced. When I first got sentenced, for me, it wasn't more fear. It wasn't more I was scared of the situation. It was more of my community, my social structure. So for me, it was more comfortable, if that makes sense. That's the sad part, and that's the sorrow that I feel, that was supposed to be my life. So for me, growing up in the community that I grew up with, that's where you earned your stripes. That's where you were the big dude on the block, or you were responsible for being the man, is when you go to prison or when you're dead. And that's just sad that we as a community have this upbringing that has tore our community down, and especially our youth. Because look at the numbers. Mm-hmm. Even like you said, the numbers are outrageous that so many black and minority are getting incarcerated, right? So for me, it wasn't a fear. It wasn't I was scared. It was more, this is where I'm supposed to be. And that's the sad part, right? So for me, I didn't realize my sentence until my transition. I realized how much time I had when I changed my life around. Because when I was still the gang member, that's the life I still respected and I understood. So it didn't affect me.
I need to clarify what you're saying.
Yes.
Because I'm not sure everyone understands it. You went in feeling like a gang member, and at some point you began to transition into the person you wanted to become.
Yes. And that comes with wisdom, that comes with age, that comes with a lot of the brothers that surround me doing the work and telling me that I need to be accountable, and there's things that need to change. Because for me, that was my life. I was either going to be dead or I was going to be in prison, and that's just what it was. So I didn't see outside the box. I was still stuck in the box, that social structure, that community, the system, the way it's put into play. So for me, I realized those numbers probably about 15, 16 years in, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to spend the rest of my life inside prison. That's when I broke down. That's when I really started crying and was like, oh my goodness, I'm going to end up dying inside of here. And then that's when the switch hit. That's when the change hit. And then that's when I was like, regardless of what happens to me, I'm going to give back. I'm going to do this work. I'm going to continue to give to them. So for me, it was the transition that made me realize what my sentence was and how sad and how horrible the situation was, because prison is another monster itself, right? Like, I know you probably want to hear about the situations and the circumstances and the living. It's horrible. It's like a third world country, right? That's what I look at as, but they may think of it some different. But for me, that's where I felt it.
And
the transition.
And those are things I'm hoping we can help people understand. Cyril, what about you? When you first heard the judge say your sentence is, what were your feelings? And then what were your feelings when you actually got into prison?
So I would say that, much of my experience echoes the sentiments that Willie just shared, you know, because I recognize how the conditions that we grew up in, and we grew up in the same neighborhood, is so reflected in how our upbringing and our experiences are shaped, right? You know, the harms that we've seen on a regular basis and just the poverty, the pain, the plights that we faced as a community. And in a lot of ways, I don't even consider it a community as much as a neighborhood, right? You know, because a community has a common unity that comes together, but there is so much pain and turmoil in the neighborhood in which we come from that we were broken down and trying to put pieces together. And so when I think about that and the way that pain began to shape each of our lives, you know, I recognize that in that moment of my sentencing, you know, I felt, you know, naturally overwhelmed, right? But, you know, I felt I had to not even express the pain, the fears, the overwhelming nature of it because I wanted to be strong for my family who I caused so much pain to. Right. You know, I wanted to allow them to see that this is going to be OK, even though I didn't believe for a second it would. Right. You know, I was trying to hold on to a hope that I couldn't even see, a future that I could only wish would be different and would not have gone the course and direction that it did. But,
you know, I was recently at a rally in Olympia called the Day of Empathy. And a gentleman there named Eugene Youngblood mentioned that we were there to talk about second chances, but he said most of the folks who are in prison didn't even have first chances, and that's what I'm hearing you gentlemen experience and talk about. How did you manage to survive and apparently thrive in the time that you spent inside prison? Each of you has come out to be an upstanding member of our community. You're working, you're supporting families, you are contributing to your community. How did you get there?
So I would like to first start by saying, while I agree with Eugene's sentiments, I can't necessarily and honestly say that that was my story. Right, because while I chose a life of crime and while I chose to commit the harms that I've caused, I also had opportunities of going to college, right? And so, you know, I want to make sure that that is reflected as well and that it was my choices, my actions that took me down a different course. And I can't blame nobody else or these other factors solely on that. Now, these other factors may contribute to that by all means, but I have to take responsibility for the fact that I chose the things that I did, and I chose to go out the night I went out, and I chose to commit the harms that I committed.
Bravo. What about the rest of you? How did you survive inside?
Well, I just two things. I would like to go back, and I reflect what Cyril just said, right? Because this was my first offense ever. I had never had anything but driving without an operator's license. So there was no previous felonies. I'm not gang affiliated or anything like that. So I had that opportunity, but I made a choice to do something different. I made a choice to live up to an image, again, that was created for me, and I chose to live that image. When we talk about surviving, it's something you have to do, right? It's something you have to do. I know a lot of people had 3 or 4 years and didn't survive that. I've seen people commit suicide. I've seen people attempt to commit suicide and survived. How do you survive in an oppressive state, right? I remember Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. I remember reading the book, and he was talking about how he survived the psychological harms that he experienced. And sometimes you have to allow yourself to go to a space, and you become desensitized to a lot of things. I won't say you suppress them. I would say you become desensitized to a lot of violence, traumas, harms, because it's almost a daily occurrence. It's something you're around daily. And so to survive it, you then have to dig deep within yourself and then surround yourself with people of like-mindedness, that when you are going through those things, that you're able to reach out to those folks, right? Our families, friends, absolutely. They play a really good part, but what happens at 10 o'clock when the lights go out,
yeah,
it's past camp. You can't get out of your cell. You're laying on the pillow with tears in your eyes, right? And you're crying because you miss, because the choice that you made have you in a situation now where you're not only oppressed, but you have to suppress the emotions that those tears are deriving from. And it's something you just have to do.
How did you find those people of like mind inside the prison? How did you distinguish them from the folks who weren't going to be so nice to you?
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Willie?
I think that's a good one for us to get in. First, I want to piggyback from the beginning a little bit and say I agree with Youngblood on his stance on the first chance. We should get the first chance because as of Youngblood, I grew up in that same environment that he grew up in, that gang environment, that crack-infested environment, right? So the lot of the opportunities we had wasn't the best opportunities that we should be taking and using in our benefit, right? So I agree where he stands because especially with me growing up in the early 90s, the crack epidemic, all this stuff, it hit hard and it just changed happy homes. Mm. Right, it changed the neighborhoods. It was no longer what it used to be. So for me, I agree with him because of like a lot of stuff that we're going to talk about, the social structures, the medical, all these different things that are put into play for their machine to run as smooth as they want it to run, right? So I wanted to get that out there. And then
so I just want to say I agree with him too. It just wasn't applicable to me.
No, yes, yes, no, yes, yeah, yeah, okay. No. Yeah, most definitely. Right, yeah, I know that. We just saying our stances. So right. I most definitely agree with that. So for me, when you ask like how can we deal with that, right? And for me, I think it's deeper than just me, right? For me, I want to go to the new Jim Crow, right? I want to go to Martin Luther King. I want to go to Rosa Parks, right? It's been happening way before me, right? This oppression and the foot on our neck, it's been happening before me. So the strength that we have as a people, that's what I want to piggyback off of, right? Just as a community, as Black people, as minorities, this strength that we have and this just to endure these things that we endure in this country. So for me, I don't even want to take sole propriety just for myself. I'm saying it's the people that came before me that gave me the strength to continue to do what we're doing, even though we're up against all these odds.
Absolutely.
You're saying within prison.
In prison as well.
Cyril?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I know that. And so that we're clear on the record, I too agree with my brother Eugene Youngblood. Right? Let the record reflect. But no, I say that because I understand that in many ways we, you know, aren't given those first chances. Right. You know, we think about the foundations of this country and the fact that Blacks were written out of so many different aspects of it. Right. And so we look at the hierarchical, the patriarchal, the male perspective in which, you know, the United States was formed and framed and who was excluded from that. Right. And so when we look at it from an institutional systemic structure, we understand that many people didn't even have that first chance. Right. Now, to my experience, you know, and my experience navigating the incarceral system when I was 17 and I first entered in, you know, I was blessed to be, you know, grabbed up by, you know, elders who saw potential in me at such a young age. Right. Well, I had my homeboys and people from my neighborhood that I also, you know, would roll with and hang out with and spend time with. The reality is I also had some of these elders who saw in me what I didn't even see in myself. Right. Those who, you know, similar to Grady, didn't have a release date, but they want to pour into me in hopes that one day I will be released. Right. And so, you know, it's amazing to see that side of humanity inside of such a dehumanizing environment where you have these men that see value in you when community, even our own families, didn't necessarily see value in us in some cases.
You know, when I listen to the three of you talk, I feel like I'm witnessing the evolution of the Black Prisoners Caucus because Grady came in with no one and it took him years to start to find people. Willie came in kind of rough and tumble and found within himself after many years. And you guys saw Cyril and young men like him and began to apply what you had been finding among yourselves to help him. Is that an accurate assumption?
So to be clear, we're saying that both of these guys are old.
Yeah. No.
I was just finna say the opposite,
younger.
Right? I'm not that old. But actually, I remember Seal coming in. And when he came in, I remember not focusing on him because it was something about him that I already knew that he was going to be okay, right? He wasn't a standout in regards of, he was a follower, right? That he was a follower. And I don't know, I'm not saying that, he wasn't an actor. He didn't cut up, right? But what I'm saying is it was just something about his level to articulate himself when he did come in that we really didn't socialize, and we were in a facility that kept us separate a lot. Sure. So I had the respect for him to know, hey, maybe do he need a lot of work? And I was more focused on some other folks. But I would say that was a pretty good analogy. It did make me feel a little old, but.
Seasoned. I like to use the term seasoned.
Yes.
Yeah. Not old.
One of the things that we stand by way of principle within the BPC is the Sankofa bird, right? Which is
Absolutely.
A bird from West Ghana, Africa. And when we think about this bird, so the bird, its body's moving forward while its neck is extending and reaching backwards. And it's holding an egg or in many of the symbols and illustrations of it, you see it holding an egg. And so this is a picture of us moving forward while reflecting back on the past and the history while caring for generations that are yet to come. Right. And so as within the BPC, this is something that we have held on to and that has really motivated the ways in which we show up for each other and the ways in which we work and operate and hold space and community. And just the fact that we're able to build community absent and apart from community inside the prison environment.
And I want some specifics on what those actions are that help you build community. I know you created a university within the prison, and it was its acronym is TEACH. Mm-hmm. What specific community actions from your Black history did you bring to developing TEACH and to supporting one another?
So I'll let Willie feel free to answer that, but it's something I just really want to say is that this shows you about. I'm glad that Cheryl talked about the Sankofa bird, right? This shows you how it goes into effect. That while I knew that he would be okay and focus my energy elsewhere, fast forward to 2013. What was about? How many years you came in when?
I came into the system.
System.
Oh, 2006.
So fast forward to 2013. He is now counseling me.
Oh.
I refer to him as my rabbi with total affection. There was not one facet of my life that he did not know about. There was not one thing that I couldn't say I need to talk to you and he wouldn't stop what he was doing to have the conversation or to listen or to encourage or to empower. This is, so I was right. When I first saw him, he did have it.
He did.
But I'm sorry, go ahead and answer the question.
Willie, go ahead.
Yes, I agree. For me, just to get specific a little bit before we can talk about TEACH, taking education and creating history, I think it just is a whole 360 of everything we're talking about, right? Like we're talking about movements, we're talking about the moments where you uplift the foot from the oppressor. We're talking about all those moments about community and brothers inside wanting better for themselves. So for us, we understood that we needed education, right? And we knew that we needed to do something bigger than what was going on. So we said we're going to have our own liberation inside, right? So this, we said liberation, education. So let me give you a little backstory on why that we took this stance and believed that we needed education. Because anyone who had 7 years or more could not get any associate's degree or could not get any higher education.
The you only thing you the Department of Corrections,
the Department of Corrections
prohibited you if you had a longer than 7 year sentence you had longer from than getting education.
If you had longer than 7 years, you could not get no education in the Washington DOC except for a basic GED, and you may get a few computer classes, but you couldn't get no associate's degrees or anything of this nature. So for us, we was last on the list for even classes that they did offer, betterment classes, any type of classes. If you had 7 years or more, you couldn't do it. So for us, we understood that even though we were inside, we still believed that we had the right to learn. We had the right to be better. We had the right to make ourselves advance our education. So for us, what we ended up doing is we ended up starting taking education and creating history, right? And we started a university inside that I can't even keep the count right now how many people got associate's degrees and how many people got credits and how many institutions. I know we're in three institutions now. It started at Collin Bay, but now we're at three institutions that we're giving a full scholarship run. We're not only that, we're also facilitate our own classes, right? Because we understand how we learn, we understand our process. So for us, it's more hands-on learning, and we come with cohorts, and we come together in classes, and we facilitate things. So it went from Collin Bay, and then it went to Stafford Creek, where Surreal ended up being the president there, and he took it to another level. So it's just been advanced. But the biggest thing that we want to say is the reason that we started Teach, and also many of these other programs that they're involved with, Roosters, all these other programs, is because DOC was not allowing us to have these.
That was my question. How did you manage to pull this off when DOC was saying you people with long sentences can't get educations? How did you manage to get associate's degrees and to get those other institutions involved?
So it took a lot of work. It took a lot of hard work. It took a lot of late nights, right? It took a lot of organizing. It took a lot of community, right? And I think that was our biggest focus point, was having community involved. Because when you have community involved and you have people involved, that's where we really started seeing the numbers, the power in the numbers, right? So when you start having these people knock on these doors and send emails and do these things and say things are wrong and they shouldn't be like that, now they're exposed. Now they understand something got to change. So that's what it came to. Like, everyone started pushing a hard line. And not only that, you got to realize we're in a closed custody facility. And I don't know if the viewers know what that means, but this is high custody. This is not, it goes minimum, medium, and then high. This is where they send everyone who's the worst of the worst, right? So for us to try to organize something to be better when the majority of them is already doing wrong, right, that's where the accountability came into play. That's where the leadership skills, and then just collaborating with other races. I think that was the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. European descent, Asian Pacific Islander, Meso-American, these other organizations, and just saying that we deserve better. We can do better, and then took off.
Yeah, you know, to piggyback on what my brother's saying, you know, it's so important to express to our viewers that we recognized within the conditions that we're in that the power to change our conditions lie within ourselves, right? We didn't have to depend on anybody else to change what we knew needed to be changed or to fix what we knew needed to be fixed. That's both internally and externally.
So I'm curious about what kind of support you got from the Department of Corrections, and if you didn't get any support from DOC, was it people on the outside working in your behalf who managed to legitimize, if you will, your program?
I can say when we started at Collin Bay, we had a few staff that was on board, right? DOC really wasn't on board because they didn't know our intentions, right? You put a whole bunch of people in a room that's already been highly involved in the activities that's going on in this prison, and now you think that they're coming in here and they're organizing and they're doing things against the rules. So DOC wasn't on board at first until they started seeing the results, right? Results make everything better. So when they started seeing that the institution was changing, they started seeing that the violence was down, and we started putting the statistics together and showing them that things are changing and people and education is better and it's liberation and it's stopping things going on in this institution, that's when they started being on board. But from the beginning, we had community. We had a few people, and we also had just a couple staff that was on board with us, that was pushing a hard line, that was going to the administration and talking to the people they needed to talk to give us that chance. But when they gave us the chance, you see what we did with it.
Yeah, it's incredibly powerful, because now I'm seeing at least two people who had long sentences out. How did your work with Teach help you manage to change your sentences? Grady?
Well, I can't answer the question specifically because I never was involved with Teach except as a supporter, right? But I think I'm one of the oldest members here of the Black Prisoners Caucus, which was in 1983 when I joined. And I would just like to say that while the Black Prisoners Caucus was formed to be a voice, a collective voice for those that are incarcerated and things that we're enduring, the racism, definitely oppression that was prevailing at that time, a lot of overcrowding, things like that going on within the system. I can say with great confidence that we never had the vision of the brilliance that these young men have now taken the Black Prisoners Caucus to, and it still has more to come. Right. So I always smile when I hear about Teach, when I see these young men, because that was our vision. Right. Highlight the greatness. You know, if they're going to come in, how can we highlight their greatness? How can we be that voice, be that example, and support them? Right. In their brilliance and greatness. And now they have the platform and they're doing an excellent job with it. But I have to let them answer specifically to the question.
Yeah, you know, I definitely want to acknowledge, you know, just the history of the Black Prisoners Caucus. So our collective was birthed out of necessity in 1972, right? And we have existed since. And the ways in which we have built community inside of the carceral system, you know, starting at Washington State Reformatory and then eventually expanding to, I believe, every prison in the state of Washington, and being able to see that growth and see the need for the work in which we're doing, right? And so many things that we've been able to contribute and do from prison have trickled out and have impacts in community, right? I believe it was out of our collective that Career Bridges was birthed. It was out of our collective that even the organization that I work for, University Beyond Bars, was birthed. Right, you know, understanding the correlation between education and incarceration, as well as the correlation between education and recidivism. Right. And so when we realize that because of the lack of education or lack of educational access, people come to prison in the first place and return to prison on the back end of that. Right. And now when we connect those factors, we see that there's still, while BPC was at Monroe, right, at the Monroe Washington State Reformatory, other chapters were popping up and things began to spread out. And we realized that, you know, we still needed to work, right? And there is where Willie and other brothers began to birth and create the Teach program, right? Which is taking education and creating history. And through that, we continue to see the need for education. We continue to break down these walls and barriers by way of the policies that have prohibited people from getting access to education. And now we begin to see that it's not only the men, but also the women at Purdy who are also doing great work. Our sisters at Purdy, the Washington Correction Center for Women, are doing powerful organizing out of that space, understanding the need for education. And I know many of them are connected with FEPS and other, you know, organizing spaces and work that's taking place.
We are almost out of time, and I am shocked. There's so much more I would like to know. And I know that all of you have worked on helping people who are getting out of prison to re-enter into society. In 1 minute, can you tell us what's the biggest obstacle for a person coming out of prison to return to being an active and productive and comfortable citizen?
Me personally, I would say technology, if I just had to pick one, because these are a lot of people's situations are different when you're talking about reentering society. Some people may need housing. Some may need a job. Some don't. They have all those things already in place, right? So there's no cookie cutter process. But one thing I think the challenge is technology, because it's an ever-evolving, rotating. I mean, some people have never been to prison having difficulties with technology, right?
Right.
So the technology aspect, I think, is the greatest challenge. Understanding, being aware of the dangers of social media, the internet, how these things will follow you for a lifetime. If you make the wrong post on Facebook, per se, or Instagram, and now you're going for an $80,000, $90,000, job, they're going to look at those posts. Now, how does that affect you, right? And understanding these things. And so, yeah, that's, and I was just even sharing that on the way over, is that that's one of the things we're attempting to address, is that by when people come out, providing them with a free laptop, free mobile hotspot, as well as a 6-hour class, right, through the House of Mercy. So,
and there are a bunch of us who haven't been in prison who could use that as well. One last thing, and what do you want our listeners to walk away with? And I'm going to ask, Willie, can you give us that?
Yes. For me, I want our listeners to walk away, just like they've been saying the whole time, humility, right? Just being able to understand that everyone's human, right? I think that's the biggest thing. Like, for me, like, I want that, because if we understand that, I think it'd make the world a better place, right? That's what we live off of. But one real quick thing before that, BPCG, Black Prisoners Caucus Community Group, Black Prisoners Caucus Community, you said, what can we do to help those that's coming home? That's what we're working on right now. So we're able to, because it's not just one thing that certain people need. It's a whole bunch of different little things, because everyone's different in their transition. So that's the work that we're doing, and we're building our organization from ground zero. We need all the help we can. We're trying to get this thing up and going. That way we can support those coming home with all the needs, their housing, technology, everything they need. So that's what we're working on. That's what we're doing. And we need help to build this thing.
Is there a website people can go to?
Yes.
What is that?
Oh, no, not yet, huh? Not yet, but we will have
it.
But
if we Google Black Prisoners Caucus, we're going to find things.
Yes.
Grady Mitchell, Willie Nobles, and Cyril Walrond, thank you so much. And thank you, folks, for listening. This has been Real Talk, where curiosity chases truth. It's a Real Talk special, and I thank you all for listening. Take good care and stay tuned to Voice of Vashon. Many thanks to Voice of Vashon for their support in making this show possible.